Well, folks, welcome to one more edition of Politics and Rhetoric. Berto Willis, your host. Thank you so kind for being a part of the show. We are going to have a great show for you today.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Okay, on tap for today is Dr. William Bronston, who's going to talk about single payer and what he thinks the single payer sector needs. We're also going to cover some stuff with Boeing and the progressive agenda. But beforehand, if Bruce Pollard has some information, you know, our callers always, I repeat, our callers always come first. So, Bruce, give me a call. You know the number, 281-823-7747. Again, that number is 823-7747. May Wood is in the house. Good afternoon, May Wood from Long Beach, California. Eric Hayes is in the house from Atascocita, Kingwood, Texas. We have Bruce Pollard in the house from Kingwood, Texas. Michael Rutnan in the house from Brooklyn, New York. We have, let's see who else. Yvette Avery Herod from Atlanta, Georgia. We have, and I don't have the rest yet. But anyway, as people call in, as people chime in, I'll be sure to call you out. We have Mitch. Hey, Lee Grant. Hey, y'all. Montgomery County, Texas. Michael Rudnin says, Boeing used to be the standard by which aircraft were measured until they had a corporate takeover. Profits over standard, right? Yeah, look. I keep telling people that our economic, look, if you have an economic system that says the following, it is the efficient allocation of resources. You don't hear anything about humanity or anything of that nature. Let's talk about the efficient allocation of resources, what that means. What is efficient? Efficient in the case of our economic system, capitalism, mean the maximization of the dollars for a few. That doesn't say me saying that. That's what Alan Greenspan says. That's what the father of capitalism said, right? So let's be clear here. There, Adam Smith never... Well, Adam Smith, from what I understand, did talk about humanity, etc. But I don't even give a damn about Adam Smith and being the founder of capitalism or all of that. I only care about how an economic system is working today and how it works with people, right? And the fact is, it is a failure for most, right? We would think that one wants to work to continue living, eating, etc., but also to give him or her a pleasant life experience. Not that you have to work so hard that you're stuck in a mine, stuck in an office, stuck with having to work 80 hours a week or however many just to support your family and start the next day again. That's not a life. But in a system that says one sector can grow faster than the other, that the capital sector grows faster than the other, it means that every single day they are taking a bigger piece of the pie than you are. And every day your proportion of that pie goes down. And if that is the case, ultimately the default, the derivative, right? If you find the it ultimately becomes, right, that you are an indentured servant. Also, new parlance, it's also known as antiseptic slavery. I mean, that's not me saying this. That's a mathematical formula says it, right? If you have a pie that's growing at a constant rate, let's say a pie that's growing at 3% a year on average, let's say, but if the wealthy is getting 7% every year, as that pie grows 3%, they take 7% growth. What happens to the rest of the growth? You don't get it. They get it. So they get, if they're growing at 7% and you are growing at 2%, it tells you they're getting a bigger pie, part of the pie. And eventually, as you derive, the derivative, what happens is that you reach to that point where you get next to nothing. But of course, it never goes to zero. You just keep getting less and less and less. You never touch zero. The mathematical formula, you never touch zero, but you keep getting less and less and less. That is the formula governing our economic system. The only way we mitigate that is through something called redistribution. But the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation, whenever you use that word redistribution, they look at you like you're crazy. That is trying to take something from those who have earned it, right? Redistribution is taking something from someone who has earned it. No. What redistribution does is it fixes an aberration in our economic formula. That's all. I mean, when you look at our economic system solely from a mathematical standpoint, I'm not talking about what you may think social-wise or all these other things. Just look at the math. The math of our economic system says it is not sustainable. That's just the math. That's just the math. I didn't invent that 1 plus 1 is 2. I didn't invent that 10 divided by 3 is 3.333333333. I didn't invent that. All right. So the reality is we have to have, people like to call it about regulated capitalism. Regulated capitalism ain't capitalism, because immediately as you say regulated capitalism, you've removed the tenets of what capitalism is. What we want to have is a free enterprise system with a very strong social safety net. That ain't capitalism. That is freedom. There's a difference. Capitalism ain't freedom. No matter what you've learned in school and what they've tried to teach you and how they've tried to indoctrinate you and how they try to tell you that anybody who speaks out against capitalism, somehow there's something wrong with them. They're communist. Until we take on these issues head on, we will continue to keep Americans dumb into believing that somehow this system, one can get ahead, that the many can get ahead. The system depends on the oppression of the many. Period. Anybody wants to call me and argue that point can. Mr. Bruce Pollard, how are you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing pretty well.
Excellent. Let me change the speaker here so we don't get some feedback. I need to fix this real quick. There we go. All right. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Good. How you been feeling these days, Bruce? We haven't gone for coffee in a while.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, coffee's the best thing for me. That gives me the extra energy, that caffeine. Anytime you want to do it, or you want to bring some other people so we can sit and
exchange viewpoints.
We can.
Yeah, we need to do that. We need to get the posse out here in the area and say let's go out for some coffee. That would include Eric Lee Grant. What's her name? Who else is in the chat right now? Who else is in the chat? Well, all our sisters. Okay. Anyway, what's up? What's up, my friend?
Yeah. Well, so I've been thinking about what the Congress has been having these hearings and attacking the women who are presidents of our universities.
Yeah.
And about whether they should be controlling the students who want to demonstrate to make people aware of what's happening in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And They're confusing the demonstration like that with anti-Semitism, which mm-hmm. I don't think it is.
It isn't.
And so, I mean, that seems simple enough. But then, you know, just before we, just before your show today, I reread the Powell Memorandum, and there are some striking similarities to what that group is doing. First off, to McCarthy, and second off, to what Powell said had to be done to rein in the universities.
Exactly. Man, Bruce, we've been taught. You know what's so funny? We actually are seeing everything that we sit back here and discuss here on this program with regards to how people don't see how insidious the Powell memo is and how effective it has been used by the Heritage Foundation and others to really, you know, let me tell you something. I sent a tweet to J.D. Ballard this morning, because J.D. Ballard had a woman on. I think she was a Jewish scholar or something. And the first thing she said is, you know, everybody's giving Israel a hard time. Ask about Hamas. And, you know, and it is like the attempt to change the subject. And then she said, we are losing the PR battle. Iran is winning the PR battle. The only reason Iran is winning the PR battle is because the West has given them all the talking points they need to win the battle. It's not by an accident. But anyway, go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, so I hear that. And when I listened to the exchange and some of the talks that they have, even the people that I would expect, the representatives that I would expect to be reasonable, get in a way that they feel as though they have to attack each other. And
yeah.
I don't know exactly how to use the word weaponize, but it's as though the interaction of Congress with people, different people, I mean, the safety, the airline safety people and mm-hmm. and the people who are presidents of the university, like they're being continually attacked at a higher level rather than having a dialogue which allows us to try and understand what's going on and some of these things, they just, it's another way of wasting time instead of getting done what needs to be done.
You nailed it. Actually, you know, you nailed it. I mean, our system does the look, Bruce, if we spend all our time fighting each other, you know, and arguing and keeping everybody at a high rate of, their blood pressure high, et cetera, we don't get a chance to tackle the problem. It is like, let me give an example that I use, and I'm going to get, I must get racial here. What I've been telling people is stop allowing the racial words to have an effect on you. What do I mean? Let's say somebody looks up on my screen and calls me the N-word, right? I have two responses I can have, right? I can get mad and start calling this person the R-word, and I can do all of that. But all that guy did was had some vibrations within the air. And if I let his vibrations within the air affect me, all the other things that I need to get done, I can't, because I'm so concentrated that this guy vibrated air in such a manner that it said the N word. What I'm trying, and yeah.
It should ring a warning bell to you.
Well,
that something is less than safe is going on. Like when we walked into that mini mart out in wherever it was.
Yes.
Yeah.
True.
You just need to be ready. That's the shame of the whole thing. It stops the karma, the good karma. You know.
Yes.
You know, but everybody deserves the best karma they can get.
You're absolutely right, Bruce. Mm-hmm. Now, I tell you, I mean, I see you read that. Either you read that part or I told you that story about going into that. There, I have like three or four stories about going into a room. All right, the one in the Ozarks was the funniest one, though, because the one in the Ozarks, I kind of didn't.
Yeah.
For some reason, I didn't have a clue. With my friends, so we got to get the hell out of here.
Well, you knew what when we went on off Sorter Road, when we went on the place off Sorter Road, you were all there already. So
yes, I was there already. But it is amazing, right? It is amazing. But anyway, my friend, look, Bruce is absolutely right.
Yeah,
we should all reread the Powell memo. We should all reread the Powell memo, because what's going on now is a fact. And Bruce, I tell you something. Yeah. That is why
it's a continuation. Go ahead, it's a continuation, and we've got to be careful. And the way it's being attacked, it looks like that I don't want to say weaponizing, but I guess that's the word. They're using techniques to bring down women who are bringing a different way of thinking of things to education and learning. And someplace there's another Powell memo, I bet, that says, we got to stop these women from running this place because they're going to screw up our ability to make money and rule the world. So,
yeah, but you know what, Bruce, that's why we keep doing. That is why we have to keep doing what we're doing. And that is why we, you know, they're dependent on us to give in and give up. Okay. That's the idea, to give in and give up. All the things that I put out there all of the times, Bruce, is like, look, those of us who've made that commitment that says we're not going to give in and we're not going to give up. You know, like what I decided to do here, this is for life, brother. You know, and I know in your retirement, you're doing a whole lot of good for life as well. I mean, this is what we have. Look, it's not going to solve itself on its own. It's going to only solve itself with engaging everybody. And when I say everybody, I mean, even those people that you think you don't like. You know, even those people you think you don't like. And notice I said, even those that you think you don't like. Because what is interesting that I found out in talking to people over and over again is there are people that I thought I would abhor, I would hate because of some of the things that they say. And then you sit down and you talk to them and suddenly they say something about their kid or whatever. And it's like, damn, I wonder what really happened to this guy.
Yeah.
Because deep inside him, he's not.
Well, face to face. Face to face, and in the media, we need to have the same attitude towards each other, which means polarizing speech is not going to get us to the point where we can sit next to each other and make some agreements and compromise and get things to where everybody will be in a better place and not feeling as though they've been put upon or judged improperly.
I agree.
Okay,
and
sir.
Sometimes
well, I just
we
thought,
fail
I'd give
at
you,
it.
Thought I'd give you a call and tell you I'm thinking about that connection with the Powell memo and what I'm seeing happen here to the women who are
brother.
The presidents of the universities and the lady who was the alma mater in USC, and then some reason they told her she couldn't give her speech because she had participated you know, I can't imagine back in the days that might have happened. I wasn't the alma mater, but people that I knew up at that next level, they were doing the anti-Vietnam picketing that I was doing at the same time. And
I get you, bro.
There were ramifications to that as well.
All right, man.
Great.
Well, thank you, Bruce, for calling
in.
And
well,
give,
everybody
give
take good on that
Susan my regard.
I will. And,
absolutely.
And I hope Linda's doing well.
Yes, sir. Thank
Great.
You very much,
Okey-doke.
Guys. We'll talk.
Take it easy. Have a good weekend. And we'll be doing some work. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you very much for that call, Bruce. And now I got another call. Let's see. Oh, no, that was an accidental call, I guess, from Bruce. I thought it was another call. Anyway, I'm going to go play our video now with Dr. William Bronson. Well, wow, it's 3:24. It's 24 minutes long. That would end it at 48. All right, let me ask you guys. No, I better play it. I do have the time to play it. I do have the time to play it. Let's go ahead and play Bronson. All right, let's do that right this minute. Welcome to another edition of Politics and Right. I'm Egberto Willis, your host. Born and educated in Los Angeles, California, Dr. William Bronson received his MD at the University of Southern California School of Medicine, completed his internship in pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, and was a resident in psychiatry at Menninger School of Psychiatry in Topeka, Kansas. But today, this is the second time that we've had Dr. Bronson on, but today we have a special subject to discuss: single payer, our healthcare system, and much, much more. Folks, we have to realize that these are some serious times. So before we get any further, welcome to Politics Done Right, Dr. William Bronson. How are you doing today?
What a wonderful honor to be with you, my dear brother. Thank you very much.
Well, look, let me tell you, it's always great speaking to you. First of all, what has happened since the last time we've spoken? I think that's probably over a year ago or so.
Geez, you know, I've had a lot of interviews and I've been struggling to try and penetrate the community of single payer activists in the country. Not successfully yet. The reason is that, you know, the healthcare system in our society touches every millimeter of our lives. I mean, there's no area where health is not somehow an issue. And in our society, the medical market system, the wealth transfer system that we refer to as a healthcare system, essentially is controlled by these gigantic cartels, the pharmaceutical cartels, the insurance industry, the hospital industry, the medical equipment industry, and to try and change people's thinking about what single payer has meant for the people that have been working on it for the last 60 years. 60 years is very, very challenging. People have not stopped in the last six decades to really reinvent, to imagine what a transformed system would look and feel like, and what had to be done to transform the culture and the society and the psychology of the universe of the mass of the population of the United States in that endeavor. That's okay. Why it's, yeah.
Let me stop you there, because what I want you to do is to, so that we can, first of all, I'd like this to be for two audiences. One, the activists within the single payer movement, which you said you may have some difficulty penetrating, and then the audience at large, the masses, the ones who are scared of anything that sounds, they don't like what they have, but they don't know what something else is.
I understand.
So
I understand.
Let's start with, where do you see single payer as it is today and its flaws?
Well, there are some things that need to be done to encourage, comfort, secure the mass. And I'm absolutely clear that we must mobilize millions of people, because it's going to require a direct vote in America, whether we're talking about a state single payer model or a national single payer model. The people are going to have to rise up in their own interest. So the need to have, where there are organized, ordinary working class people, and connect with them is critical. The trade union movement, the religious community, the church community, the advocacy community, a poor people's campaign, on and on, move on, all of that. And the issues that I think would inspire and transform the mass to understand the benefits to them include things like, number one, ending all medical debt. Everybody is sitting here with billions of dollars of debt that we could buy out roughly at a dollar per thousand or even more than that. I know that for sure. And so that has to happen. We need to fundamentally look at the enormous amount of savings, investments, and prosperity that would come with a universal single-payer rightful system for the masses. We need to look at the whole issue of organizing neighborhood assemblies, which every county in the United States has neighborhood assemblies that are legitimate groups that need to be pulled out, organized into networks, and connected to their local public health officers in their counties in order to monitor, to plan, to essentially prioritize, and to report to the general population. There needs to be a conversation in the general public that doesn't exist yet. People are very isolated from one another. And the whole campaign, the political campaign to communitize, to popularize the idea of well-being, not wellness, well-being as a general phenomenon, as an experience, cultural experience in the population, is a crucial discussion that has to be articulated, proper language, and proper approach to the general population through programs like yours and others that reaching, you know, tens of thousands and millions of folks to think about the benefits that would happen.
I think if I'm understanding you correctly, and I think I am, I think you're implying that whereas the single payer movement right now is sort of a bit middle heavy, I don't want to say top heavy, but middle heavy in the folks who know the concepts and et cetera, you're saying it's likely stagnating because you don't have the uplift from the people. And the only way to get that is to really start much of what some of us believe in, grassroots movement on the county level, on the precinct level, by showing interest, having mass movement in all these groups. And I see a carrot in what you just mentioned. You talk about medical debt. Right now, there's a hell of a lot of medical debt on the books of the plutocrats that are there to take your money. They know that most of that money they're not going to get, but they keep it on the books so that when you die, maybe they get your house. When you die, maybe they'll get everything that's left. What's the buy-in for the American citizen? Hey, they've pretty much taken a lot from us already. Let's start talking about buying this debt off, clearing the slate, and then that is a buy-in for a large percentage of Americans, clearing that debt, that undeserved debt, and moving forward from there. Carrots, grassroots movement. Did I get that correctly from
Absolutely
your narrative?
Right. So you know your friend Jerry Ashton, who
yes.
has been working on RIP medical
yes.
and veteran debt. And Jerry really, you know, is a hammer in terms of eliminating debt. People can't imagine being relieved of tens of thousands of dollars of debt, medical debt. Now, there's another area that we can relieve as well, and that is student debt.
Right.
So I believe that in order to transform the workforce, to get away from what we currently have and reach a much more congenial, a much more compassionate, a much more politically devoted community of health workers, we need to buy out the tuition at the post-secondary level of every healthcare professional trainee. In exchange, year for year, for assignment to an underserved area that would be engineered through something like a California Health Corps or a National American Health Corps, so that we can build comprehensivity at the local level so people can see and feel the services of caring at the local level in your home and in your neighborhood. And so we know, I spent last week at a wonderful meeting in Modesto where the state director of public health was there, and every single public health officer in the state of California was there. There were 61 public health, 61 counties, 61 officers there. We need to build a partnership between the neighborhood assembly leadership and the local public health officers in order to build that campaign and that momentum, and to determine where we need to put doctors, nurses, dentists, social workers, psychologists, med tech people. I met yesterday, I fell down the other day and I had to go for an x-ray. And the young man, a Hispanic young kid that did the x-ray, is in debt for $50,000 to become a licensed x-ray technician. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. He shouldn't have to pay a penny for that education, because what he's doing essentially is serving the community. So, you know, and he doesn't have a clue about the old idea of single payer or the possibility of not having to pay that onerous amount of money. And you look at what medical students have to pay, and nursing students have to pay, and dental students have to pay, that forces them into being carnivorous, into being charging people and needing high amounts of money. And then all of that is only one third of all that is escalated by the middlemen, by the bureaucrats that are pulling a third of all the dollars that should be allocated to caring for ourselves into their pockets. So if we eliminate medical debt, if we eliminate student debt, and we exchange that student debt for service year for year. If you go to medical school for 4 years, you got to be assigned somewhere into an urban or a rural health desert, of which the country is laden with because of the lack of adequate money driven by the current system to draw people in to provide services. So there's huge areas that don't have an obstetrician, huge areas that don't have a psychiatrist, huge areas that don't have proper dental care, neonatal services, and so forth. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. We need to fill those empty places with students, graduate students, healthcare students whose tuition we've paid, who are not in debt, and who will live and stay in those communities and likely stay there, even though they wouldn't necessarily choose to go to a poor area or an underserved area out of you know, their initial, you know, looking for a place to start a business. We have to end the business aspect of medical services and transform our profit-driven system to a nonprofit system. These are complicated challenges, Egberto, extremely complicated, and they require public consciousness. They require an understanding on the part of the mass of people that there is something transformative and comforting and securifying that could be developed if we had an adequate campaign and if people understood in the conversation the need for this radical revolutionary transformation in our culture. People have to have a feeling of caring for one another, different from what we experience right now, where there's a lot of competition and isolation.
I don't see it as complicated, in as much as we have to get that information understood. And I, now that you've explained that further, I think it almost seems like a three-prong approach. One, education on the grassroots level about what single payer is, and getting it politically devised, meaning in the political ethos. But that can only be done through these educational processes in every single precinct in our country. Two, we also have to talk about that we have to move from this system to a new. But within this current system, there's a whole lot of debt. There's a way that we relieve the debt, dollar on the thousand or something of that nature, but we get those things written off of the books. And three, the mobilization of healthcare workers through the forgiveness of student loans. I think that is a great, not only a great selling point, a great wake up, given that people have such a small, a short attention span right now because of all the other things that they have to do. Medical debt relief, a student loan for medical folks. I think it's a great way to get the attention of a large percentage of the population.
I agree. And it's not being talked about in the single payer movement. There are two other areas that are really profound. One of them is to establish the public health system at the top of the pyramid of administration of whatever we ultimately have. The public health system has been unfunded from 1980, and it's only beginning to regather its footing. But we need to not have doctors that are dealing with individual illness. We need to have MPH, Masters in Public Health, Doctors in Public Health, MD, MPH professionals trained and experienced at the top of the system so that we're looking at population health, prevention, early intervention, and getting at the root cause of disease and the problems of suffering that people are experiencing. Secondly, we need fundamentally to build a major area that looks at linking the VA and the Indian Health Service and the Federal Quality Medical Center system, which are all independent massive systems that are population-based services, into a single system where we have one way of putting all the money in one bank account in order to pay all the bills. Nobody would pay a penny at the point of service, and the entire system would be funded by tax money, for which we already have more than 80% in the bank today to provide Cadillac quality services, one tier of care for everybody in the society.
I think that that is something for many people find hard to understand. Yeah. The only reason we have a tiered system is because we are not only a tiered system. The only reason we claim healthcare is so expensive in the United States is because of the for-profit motive. And if you take a look at what every layer makes, insurance companies, the drug companies, all these folks that are actually dependent on public services, the drug companies, a large percentage of their invention, designs, et cetera, comes from the public sector, universities, et cetera. When it comes to the manufacture of equipment for your a new leg or whatever, a lot of these inventions had its genesis in the public sector, yet they don't get a piece of the action.
We funded have by to taxes.
Understand funded by taxes. We have to understand that, and once we lay that out, we make the case for, because a lot of people have a tendency to say, well, somehow the private sector does things better than the public sector. That is a figment of their imagination. That is simply, whenever the public sector fails, it's because the private sector enters and either purposefully makes it fails, or the for-profit motive makes it less efficient.
And we have the data.
People get it.
We absolutely have the data to,
yes,
to demonstrate that.
Yes.
The other thing that has to happen that really is radical is we need to end long-term care as it currently is funded by Medicaid, which is the whole thrust of my book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America. We need to replace long-term care with lifetime care,
right?
Which we have in the disability community in America. We have individualized planning for kids in education, for grown-ups in vocational services, and for people with developmental disabilities or IDA problems in the general community through the regional center system. But we've never expanded that individual planning strategy to 100% of the population, which we could do to deflect people as they age from congregate segregated institutional terminus. Lifetime care planning in order to keep people in multi-generational, community-based environments locally. And we need to fund the 41 million unfunded people that are taking care of some dependent member of their family in America by default, because the system, you know, relies upon that massive voluntary, involuntary pressure in order for folks that have special needs to be properly cared for and empowered, you know, in our society.
These things are all possible. And the thing about it is, how do we define it, and how do we prevent ourselves from being co-opted by those who feel themselves the stakeholders that would actually lose, stakeholders that don't deserve to be stakeholders, et cetera. And that, I always see that as the biggest problem. The ideas are great. Executing the ideas, great. We always get that influence from those who will then come in to try to muck it up, if you will. And one of the things that I think we as activists can do is, in the long run, to defeat that sort of a input, to make sure we have the numbers, make sure we have the numbers, and make sure that we are diligent in the way we're doing things. We're coming close to the end of the conversation, Doc, and I want to ask you to sort of summarize for me, how do we package this for the several pieces of the single payer movement, such that they can see that only through these three things that we spoke about, making it completely grassroots and completely all encompassing, can we get this done?
First of all, the thing that I've talked to you about is in detailed writing in my website, which is called ourhealth.pub.public. Ourhealth.public. And if people go there, it's broken down into lots of different pieces, very interactive, where people can read and think about what it is that we're talking about here. The second thing is, we need to make our focus and effort on mobilizing youth to take the leadership here. We need to be providing input into high school kids and into post-secondary young people in order to talk about their future as the solution here. And I believe that we have existing structures like the American Public Health Association. The Public Health Association is the largest health professional organization in the country. They need to stand up on their soapbox, and they need to hammer and trumpet the need for their leadership in a transformed healthcare delivery system. The structures are, the embryonic structures are already in America. We need to somehow juice them. We need to encourage them. We need to recruit them. We need to empower them in order to pursue this moral imperative that we cannot surrender. It is what happens is that people feel defeated and depressed, that they don't have the power to look at and change the system. And that cannot be allowed to prevail. People have to understand that if we don't change this healthcare system, we're headed for a totalitarian, anti-democratic, death-making culture and economy, which is what we're living in right now, that everybody experiences and understands, but feels that they don't have the power to swing the bat to change the system.
Folks, imagine having one card. And whenever you get sick, you go to a doctor, you never have to present a payment. You never have to present a anything but that card. Exactly. That card, health security. And whether you need medicine, whether you need surgery, whether you need to be hospitalized, that's the only thing presented, that card. And society, all of us pay for, and all of us benefit from. It is Dr. William Bronston. Thank you for enlightening. Thank you for pushing. Thank you for all that you do. We will make sure in our lifetime to get this stuff started.
In our lifetime.
In our lifetime. All right? Thank you
so kindly. Have a gander at the book. Have a gander at the book and have a gander at the website.
Thank you so kindly.
Thank you, sir.
Anyway, folks, thank you so kindly for listening to that. Breach, I actually saw some, Ashley turned me on to that, New Amsterdam. I was so impressed, and she called me down, especially when he gave the speech. about the socialized medicine. It was amazing. She just knew that she had to let me hear that. So yeah, I saw that. Or rather, I've watched several issues of it. I think that's one where the doctor that lead the place turned out he got some sort of cancer, and I think they started to cure it. I've seen it a long time ago, but yeah, thanks for saying it's a good interview, Vidich MCP. We also have Melanie Keelan is in the house from Barcelona, Spain. Great to see you here. Let's see, Mike Cisek is in the house. Did I miss anybody? If I missed anybody, just drop me a line in the bottom, and we'll take it. Yeah, it's a great show. I loved the few episodes that I saw. And you know, the problem with the show is that you start watching it and you start to get hooked. And I don't have the time to get hooked. I saw it a few times and I told my daughter laugh at me because I'm like, I'm not going to allow you to hook me to yet another show. Because when I stayed with her in DC and we were locked up in that shoebox during the pandemic and all of that, she got me hooked all the stuff, you know, but anyway. Anyway, I got one more video to show you guys. Yeah, I hear you, Vidija. I hear you. I have one more video to show you. And it has to do with Boeing. As you know, Boeing is really has really gone down as far as its compliance, as far as the reliability of its product, and it all has to do with money. And today I had a reporter call into the show, and the thing what got me upset is that this guy really knows better. But I don't understand why is it that we and Breach, you know. Yesterday, when we were talking about billionaires, I really hope people really got what I'm saying. I am saying that we have so many defects in our economic system that allows a whole lot of this to happen, right? But anyway, I'll go there afterwards if I have some time. But I want to get this piece out, this call out, and let you hear it. Let's go to Richard. Come on in, Richard.
I don't know if you guys know anything about airplanes or how that situation happened, but you have millions of people that fly on those planes, the Dreamliner and the Supermax every day. And they don't just put out planes just like that. I mean, like you guys are saying, I think the competition-wise, it was competition between Boeing and McDonnell Douglas. And that was their major competition going into the 80s. And that's when they kind of start working on the 7-3 and working on the Supermax. Problems with Supermax primarily was upper management wasn't listening to complaints from the unions and especially the pilots union that were complaining about the certain torques with the plane. And that's one of the reasons why you had the two crashes that you're talking about.
What is it that you think we didn't know that somehow doesn't purport with what you're saying?
Well, what you're talking about is a corporate. Is you talked about being a business decision, and
That was a statement. That wasn't a question that I mentioned there. That was a verifiable statement of fact that's documented. So I'm trying to, like I said on here, what we try to do is make sure documented in your own documents. I mean, actually, if you take a look at the stock buybacks, it's $95 billion. It costs $7 billion to develop a plane. If what you did was modify a plane when competition came about and you made it unstable, and my dear brother, let me just tell you categorically. One at a time. I am an engineer, sir. My dear friend, I know Bernoulli's equations, and I understood what happened with the placement of the engine of the 737. I understood that the avionics is what had to help in the control of the planes, etc. So my brother, whenever you're talking about these things, let's just talk, stick, and you know, I let everybody speak and say their piece, but be careful.
I worked on both of those planes. Right. I know you know that. Go ahead.
But what I'm saying is that I know the engineering of the plane, my friend. And in knowing the engineering, I made sure to tell our audience the fact that our economic system is a basal cause of many of our issues with safety and crashes. That wasn't a statement other than a statement of fact. Okay. And what I'm saying is if we are here to make sure people make the changes necessary that we don't have these things happen, we cannot take a corporate stance in our commentary. And that's the real issue that I want to get out there. One of the biggest drawbacks we have in the country right now is somehow the masses, you and I, some of us thinking that we always have to go to bat for these corporations. They never go to bat for you. They never go to bat on for you unless it makes fiduciary sense for them to bat for you. They don't say, we are going to give the shareholders a tad bit less to pay our workers more. They don't say, we are going to give the shareholders a tad bit less for efficient. Look, let's be clear. What Boeing did with the MAX, with the MAX, the 737 MAX, and I want people to look at a document that I have in the correspondent blog for that piece there, is they changed the aerodynamics of that plane. And so that the same pilots that flew the standard 737 could fly this one, they used software so that the controls would seem the same. Now, when people go out and say what that creates is that what that means is, if you use the same pilot using the same techniques, absent MCAS, the software system that controls the air surfaces to adjust from having a big engine that changes the aerodynamics over the plane, you took the shortcut so that, and by the way, it's not only Boeing that took the shortcut, right? The other people that loved what Boeing did was the airline companies, because they didn't want to retrain pilots. So they prefer to have a plane that is less than the best that it could, so that their pilots wouldn't have to be retrained. But when that scenario occurred, and by the way, in the manuals, the one thing Boeing didn't do, they didn't put a whole lot of changes in the manual for the MAX. And the reason they didn't is they didn't want pilots saying, oh, wait a minute, these are different. So they left it up to the software to make the controls look the same, and when the plane gets into particular situations, right? The center of gravity of the plane moved, the engines was moved to the forward, which means when you put more power onto the plane, it have a tendency to do this, which makes it aerodynamically more likely to stall. Just science again. And just science again, but they made that trade off. They made that trade off because they didn't want to redesign the airframe. And those people who died in those two crashes paid the price. And these are crashes that didn't need to occur. Now we have whistleblowers that are saying, talking about how the fuselage of the 787 was put together. I don't, you know, the thing about it is the government has been so lax in the way they treat these guys. We have to hope that going forward, they will do a check on these guys. They'll do a check on these guys. British MCP says, funny, not really. Most of the Barnes up here who took down their Trump flags now have large white painted EFF Biden since the trial. These people are sick. Well, you know, let me tell you, and I mean this, Bridge, as long as we keep the bottom from falling out, the fever will, what is the word that they always say? The fever would break. We just have to hold on. We just have to hold on. Egberto isn't even talking about why the 737 MAX has a problem in the first place. Government regulation makes it way too costly in designing airplanes. That's crap. It costs $7 billion to develop an airplane. the profits were $95 billion. They could have developed several airplanes if they just did what supposedly one does with profits. And that's hold back some of the profits for innovation. It's ridiculous about talking regulations. If we had better regulations, those planes would not have crashed. Very silly, Mike. Again, humanity over ideology. One more time, humanity over ideology. When Mike and Eric sees that, or when one of your kids die because of what these capital dropping people do, then you will change. Just like those folks who hated gay people until their kids turned out to be gay. That guy in the senator in Pennsylvania, when his son finally came out as being gay, suddenly he wanted the bill passed. When this guy finally realized his wife couldn't get health insurance, suddenly he was supporting Obamacare. We have to be more empathetic, not because something negative hasn't happened to us means that we shouldn't support it or the good things for other people. That's what Jesus would do. But the glory, glory, hallelujah singing evangelicals are some of the most, and I say this respectfully and with love, but they're some of the most inhumane people I know. And the atheists, a lot of the atheist friends of mine are some of the most humane people I know. Exactly. At least he didn't kick him out or ignore him. Well, that's true, Bridge. That's true. They changed your stance. They changed your stance. All right. I got to get out of here. I want folks to please go ahead and support our program. We couldn't do it without you. So please go to politicsandright.com/support. We haven't received any new support lately, except yesterday we got a super chat from Davenport. I want to thank Davenport for that. But I need your support for us to keep doing this the right way. politicsandright.com/patron. Can we have some more patrons? And with that, remember, you get to read all my books with becoming a patron. politicsandright.com/patron. politicsandright.com/patron. Patron is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You can also become a paid subscriber of our newsletter. That is at politicsandright.com/newsletter. politicsandright.com/newsletter. Please become a paid subscriber. And again, that will help us dearly to keep doing what we're doing. Anyway, folks, I got to get out of here. My name is Egberto Willis. This is Politics and Right. And you guys know how I end this baby. I am what?
We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead, number one, subscribe to our channel, and number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please join.